in the business of awards tonight, so I'll be here for as long as I can, but I won't be as long as normal. Last week I informed you Kevin had agreed to a government inquiry into events surrounding Philip Smith, also known as Philip Trainer, leaving the country on November the 6th. You've seen the press release from Minister Bennett announcing the draft terms of reference for the government inquiry established under the Inquiries Act. The purpose of the inquiry is to take a broader look at the circumstances surrounding this particular case and the settings across agencies and make clear recommendations to the government. There are three areas of focus that the inquiry will focus on. Firstly, the use of alternative names within the criminal justice system, including the use of passports and other types of identification. Secondly, Smith's departure from New Zealand while on temporary release. The inquiry will look at his sentence management, the assessment of his suitability for temporary release, how he obtained and travelled on a passport, and what government departments are accountable for. And thirdly, the inquiry will look at information sharing, matching and disclosure. This will extend to individuals who would be expected to remain in New Zealand by virtue of their particular criminal justice system status, including their sentence management arrangements, any relevant court orders, their parole status and the likes. The Honourable John Presley QC will chair the inquiry. He's a retired High Court judge. He will be assisted by the former head of the Department of Prime Minister and Cabinet, Simon Murdoch. The broader inquiry will run separately from the Department of Corrections review, a multi-agency review led by the Ministry of Justice. Terms of reference will be finalised following consultation with the chair and membership of the inquiry. State Services Minister Paula Bennett is the appointing minister for the inquiry to sit down for an initial period of about 6 months. However, this may be extended. I expect the report to be made public in the second half of next year based on the initial time frame. As you know, it's been a busy program of state visits into New Zealand over the last couple of weeks, following on from visits by German Chancellor Angela Merkel and Canadian Prime Minister Stephen Harper. It was a privilege to host Chinese President Xi Jinping for 3 days last week in Wellington and in Auckland. Our relationship with China is in great shape. China is New Zealand's largest trading partner, and we have agreed to characterise the relationship between our nations as a comprehensive strategic partnership. Recognising the significance of the bilateral relationship to both countries, as you know, we made a number of announcements during the President's visit, with 10 new agreements and arrangements between New Zealand and China signed. Those agreements include a television co-production agreement allowing programmes co-produced by companies into our two countries to be shown to huge audiences on Chinese television. We've agreed to extend the working holiday scheme and we've announced agreements across a number of other sectors. These include initiatives in education, immigration, food safety, tourism, trade and enterprise, and environmental issues. Just turning to migration, you'll see that Stats New Zealand data released today showing fewer Kiwis are moving overseas, more Kiwis are returning home, and more overseas residents are moving to New Zealand to live. A big milestone has been reached in terms of Australia, New Zealand's migration. 17 more people arrived from Australia than left in October of 2014. This is the first month of positive migration from Australia since December 1993. You'll see in the final draft of the Countering Terrorist Fighters Legislation Bill, and you'll note the changes proposed were set out in my national security speech earlier this month. These measures add to the safety and security of New Zealand in the short term and are necessary now because of the changing threat level domestically and internationally. The bill will be introduced and have its first reading this week. The House also intends to progress the first reading of the Education Amendment Bill, the Crimes Match Fixing Bill and Parole Extended Supervision Orders Amendment Bill and Public Safety Public Protection Orders Bill. Finally, in terms of my own activities, I'll be in Wellington today, tomorrow and Wednesday. On Thursday, I'm officially opening buildings in Christchurch and in Auckland on Friday, I'm in Harawa and Whanganui for a number of visits. Questions?
Just on the Ian Rennie's handling of the Roger Sutton case, do you think he broke the no surprises agreement when he attended that press conference last week?
Ian Rennie broke the no surprises. I don't think so, in the sense that he has complete independence for the way he handles employment matters. So my sort of understanding of it, no, I don't think so. But What I do think is it was very unwise of him to have a joint press conference. It was a miscalculation. I think it led to the perception that he was siding with one party and not the other, and I think he deeply regrets that. Fortunately, he managed to fix that situation up as best he could, very quickly, but nevertheless it was a mistake for him to have a joint press conference, and I think it was a miscalculation, a mistake for my chief executive, Andrew Kipperwhite, to be there as well.
Have you spoken to Andrew Kipperwhite about
it? Yeah, look, he sent me a pretty long email over the weekend explaining that. Good and constructive discussion with him this morning. Again, you know, his intentions were honourable. They were to demonstrate to the people of the CERA organisation that despite their chief executive announcing that he was leaving, that the government was 100% supportive of the work they do and would be providing all that support. But again, by putting himself in that joint press conference, I think he put himself in the wrong place.
Did he offer to resign?
No, he didn't offer to resign, and I didn't ask for his resignation. I wouldn't over a matter like that. He has my complete confidence. But I think it was a miscalculation in terms
is
of...
Is he on his last chance?
I wouldn't want to put it in those terms. Look, we've had a good conversation about something that I don't think he handled nearly as well as he could have. He may have had the right reasons, but the execution was poor.
It would be pretty hard to get rid of him, though, anyway, wouldn't it? Because he's on a three-year contract.
Well, I mean, that's, you know, ultimately the relationship between a minister and their chief executive is a very important one. He's a thoroughly professional individual. If he thought he didn't enjoy my confidence, I think he'd offer his resignation. You know, I'm disappointed that he got himself in the position he did. As I said, I think he was going there for all the right reasons and all the right intentions, but he got it wrong. So I don't think that's an issue.
Did Andrew Kipperwhite explain to you about how he ended up hugging Roger Sutton?
Well, he certainly offered an apology for the picture that demonstrated, which again is not one he was trying to portray, that he was siding with the chief executive. I mean, as I said the other day, look, I've only actually seen that footage once, and my brief look at that footage was that Roger actually embraced Andrew, but look, in the end, it wasn't a good look. Shouldn't have happened.
So did Andrew Kipperwhite explain that actual, you know, not just being there, because there's sort of two elements, isn't there? There's one, that he was there, and two, that he ended up in an embrace.
Well, I think he was surprised by that, but I don't think if you look at the footage, he initiated that either.
What do you make of Labour's reshuffle?
Well, this is going to be a seething backbench of misery and discontent, isn't it? I mean, you've got from sort of 13 to 17, you know, with the exception of Parker, they're all former leaders. Can't see how they're going to be terribly happy. You know, Robertson in the finance role, I don't know, and King's hardly the face of the future, but we'll see how it goes.
Do you think that Ian Rennie, I mean, you told him that he had to fully investigate every claim. Do you believe he did that?
I've never seen the report, because I'm not a party to it. I can tell you only what I know, which is some weeks out from the particular press conference and the actions that were taken, I was made aware of the fact that there was this issue and it was being investigated. I made it completely clear to the chief executive, as the State Services Minister did, that nothing less than 100% thorough and professional investigation was required. Now, in the end, you know, like others, you know, I've heard rumours and seen the media reports that there were a number of people that were complainants, if you like, or at least had issues, but only one formal complainant. And all I can say is I can't tell you where the law starts and stops. That's a matter for Ian Rennie, State Services Commissioner. But any legitimate complaint that could legally follow up on, I would expect him to have done that.
So you think Ian Rennie should front up so we can probe him on exactly where the confusion is? Because there seem to be some people who are quite confused about what exactly the investigation is trying to establish.
Well, you're certainly welcome to go and ask him that. I mean, at the most basic core of it, I would have thought it's pretty self-explanatory. The investigation was as a result of a complaint of sexual harassment, and the findings of the report were that while it was not a dismissible offence, it was a serious offence.
But shouldn't the investigation have been trying to establish the nature of the conduct?
Well, you have to ask him that, but I mean, in the context of this, it's his responsibility as State Services Commissioner, and someone that was responsible for the inquiry to ensure that any formal complaints that came forward were investigated.
Just to clarify, is Ian Rennie on his last chance now?
If you have a look at Ian Rennie, he has been in the public service, I think, for the better part of 30 years. He started in 1986 in Treasury. This is a guy who is actually a very bright guy. He's been around the state services for a long period of time. In my experience, he's been thoroughly professional. He's made a complete botch up of this particular press conference by putting himself in the same position as holding a press conference with the outgoing chief executive, because he's allowed a perception to be created which is the wrong perception. And I think he deeply and utterly regrets that. But, you know, in the end, from time to time, people make mistakes. And he's made one, but he's been a bipartisan state services commissioner. He was appointed under Labor, he was promoted under Labor, and he's been retained by my government. So, yeah, I mean, if he made lots more mistakes in the future, I think he'd hold himself to account and would do something about that. But, you know, in the end, he's managed to allow a joint press conference to be held that's developed in, you know, what is an unlevel playing field. And I think it's given the perception that he's favoured one side of the dispute to the other. Now, he's fixed all of that up as quickly as he can, but he himself would tell you he should never put himself in that position.
You know, when it comes to the perceptions of the Smith Trainer inquiry, how independent can that inquiry be seen to be when a former head of the DPMC is essentially involved in it?
Well, the reason that Simon Murdoch's been selected, I mean, the inquiry will be headed effectively by Justice Priestley, who I think is highly respected as a former High Court judge. In terms of Simon Murdoch, because it goes across so many other government departments and agencies, the view, I think, was it was important to have somebody that would understand not only those government departments, but also interaction between them. I mean, Simon's done a lot of work post his time as the head of either DPMC or Foreign Affairs, and I think he's successfully discharged those reports and responsibilities thoroughly professionally. I mean, he was, again, an extremely well-respected public servant. So I don't think there's any issues. At one point was formerly the head of DPMC. I think it's more important he understands the workings of those different departments.
I wasn't meaning your perception of his work. I was meaning the public's perception of the inquiry.
I think in the end, you know, anyone who would be interested in the name of the individual would know that Simon's so thoroughly professional that I don't think they have an issue with that.
Can you stand by went against advice and held this press conference? And if so, shouldn't you have an inquiry to get to the bottom of these companies?
We can have endless inquiries. They cost a lot of money, and in the end, they not necessarily take you very far. He went against that advice, one assumes, because he didn't accept that advice was right. You get lots of advice when you're a chief executive or when you're a minister or whatever it might be. People get advice all the time. It doesn't mean they always accept it. If he had accepted it, well, he wouldn't have been in that position. And he was obviously getting the right advice, but nevertheless, that's the way it goes.
The woman who gave that advice is now on sick leave and has been for some time. Is that because of her advice being ignored?
No, my understanding is that she's genuinely unwell, but you need to ask her.
Just on the foreign fighters legislation, you said you were looking for bipartisan support for that and indicate that you might not press ahead with it if you didn't get that support. How is that working?
Well, hopefully pretty good. There's a very legitimate case. You know, we don't have the luxury of saying we can do nothing, because what's clearly been identified is, I think, holes in the current settings. So we're doing everything we can to work with Labor and the other political parties that would legitimately support us. My understanding is some initial soundings of them are positive, but it'll need to go through a process, and in the end, I think all that Labor are saying is that they'll vote for it in the first reading, and we'll see how it goes from there, but with a bit of luck, they'll support it.
Andrew Little said he was sceptical about the need for some of the measures in the legislation, and also said that that Labor hadn't had a briefing on it. I mean, we know that there was a briefing on a wider issue some weeks ago. Do you intend to sort of give him a more detailed briefing on the legislation?
Yes, so my understanding is they've had quite a few briefings that have been with different parties, and he's probably been pretty busy, so how much he's actually caught up with those individual discussions that have been held with other, you know, parts of their leadership team prior to taking over, I don't know. But in terms, I think his main concern, and the main concerns seem to be settling around the 48-hour period where SIS could undertake surveillance without a formal warrant. My understanding is that the director of SIS is going to try and personally give him a briefing on some of the actual examples that would have been captured by the law if it had been changed and why it's necessary, but then we'll work our way through that.
Will they build the evidence first reading tomorrow?
Yes, so I think it will go through under agency so that it can go straight off to the Select Committee. And from memory, it goes to the Foreign Affairs Select Committee.
Do you stand by your comment that New Zealand was peacefully settled?
Yes, absolutely. And I believe I'm right. So there's always going to be a range of views, but if you look at New Zealand, one of the defining and unusual factors about New Zealand was that you had Maori and the Crown, signing the treaty in 1840, and that was a peaceful time for the most part in New Zealand. What's absolutely true is that during the period of colonisation between 1845 and 1875, there was obviously significant conflict in the New Zealand wars, and everybody understands that, but that was a period of colonisation.
How is that different to settlement?
Because I would define settlement as the point at which the treaty was signed, which is the founding document of New Zealand. And I've been to quite a number of speeches where historians have said exactly the same thing. You'll always find some people who say settlement is the period that took place after that. In the context that I was using it, that's not correct. That's not the context I was using it. It's a very unusual situation in New Zealand. You go around and look at most countries in the world, they were either established through a civil war or whatever it might have been, the very different set of circumstances. New Zealand wasn't. It's one of the unusual and defining features of New Zealand.
On the economy, are you still confident that government can reach a surplus this financial year?
Yes, but as you will have seen from Bill English's comments, the HAIFU is going to be challenging. There are a number of different factors in there. And you know, ultimately what that final HAIFU number looks like, we'll know very soon. But even if it was to show a small negative number, it doesn't mean that's actually what the number will be when the surplus or deficit, if that was to be the case, is finally determined for the 14-15 year. Historically, when you look at the HAIFU, there's been a lot of very wild fluctuations that have taken place. So we've had times where it's been out, the HAIFU number's been billions of dollars different from the actual surplus or deficit of the year. So, yeah, at the moment we can see a few challenges in there, and we'll see how it plays out, but overall we think numbers are looking okay.
In any of your discussions with President Xi, what did you learn about the Chinese economy and how that might affect us? Because over the weekend they had to loosen
the cash. Yeah, so the cash rate. Look, he is still very confident of their growth numbers. Basically, they're saying by 2021, which I think is the 100 years of the sort of commemoration of the centenary of the Communist Party, they want a double per capita GDP growth. So on their numbers, they're 7,000 US per capita. Our numbers would have them slightly higher than that, but we'll accept their numbers. They'll know what they're talking about. And he is saying to grow, to get to doubling that number, 14,000, I think, by 2021, they need to grow at 6.5% a year. And they think that's quite conservative on their modelling. So they are changing the structure of the Chinese economy. They're very much focused on not just the top line GDP number, quite focused on quality of living, the quality of their environment, the urban sort of rural split, and the GDP per capita growth. So he told me they were not that concerned by the GDP top line numbers slowing down. They expected that because of some of the steps they're taking. They're much more worried about the longer term issues.
Does it not concern you that they haven't really returned to start buying up milk powder and grape?
Well, he is very confident they are going to buy New Zealand products in sort of very prolific way. And actually that matches up with, when we saw COFCO, for instance, are the biggest importers of food in the world. When we saw them in China for APEC, they confirmed consumer demand's very strong. Obviously, like everyone, we can see that there's some slowdown happening. But the slowdown's happening in the credit markets, and particularly to slow their housing market, not necessarily on the consumer side. What drives the consumer side is the GDP per capita income. As he pointed out, they've got 300 million people currently now sitting in what they think is about middle income, defined on their terms, and that number's going to grow.
What's
Have
the status
seen
of
being briefed on the IGS report?
Yes, I've seen it. So I don't know if I've been briefed on it, but I've read it.
Thoughts?
I'm not in the position to comment about it, but the Inspector General will release the report pretty soon.
He's talked about it.
Reflects well on your office.
Like I say, it's best that you read the report and you can draw your own conclusions.
But who'll read it would be interested in what your thoughts on it.
I'm sure you'd be absolutely fascinated in my thoughts on it, but that would be very disrespectful to Cheryl Glynn.
I mean, it slams your office, I'm told. You don't want to defend your office.
You come and ask me when you read the report.
Phil Cox called the press conference tomorrow morning to talk about its findings.
Yep.
What implications should we take from that?
Well, he's holding a press conference.
Do you think the findings are critical of your office? Do you think it will make you quite bad? And if it does, would you take steps to address those guys?
Okay, so you just asked me the same question again, and I'll just give you the same answer.
Just going back to those the China trade, what's the status of those safeguard caps on the dairy exports?
Yeah, so that's a subject of discussion with the President, and I'm confident over time we can do things to modernise our FTA.
So in the meantime, we'll still be at that disadvantage with Australia?
There'll still be, but yeah, it's true, but I mean, Australia will have, I haven't looked at all the finer details of Australia, but it'll have its own phase out, it's just that it doesn't have those safeguard caps. It does that over a quicker period of time. But, you know, 6 years is a long time in FTA land. You know, things have evolved.
I thought the rule was that if another country got a better deal, we would automatically ratchet up to those conditions.
It's quite a technical issue, I think, on how most favoured nations status works in those FTAs. I don't claim to understand exactly why this rule wouldn't be covered, but I know it's not covered because I know that we need to go and deal with it. Okay. Thanks, Ross.